Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists here, and by Dr. Carl Benzio, one of the co-founders of Honey Lake Clinic and the chief psychiatric officer here at Honey Lake Clinic. And today we're going to be talking about decision-making as your superpower. And I know that Dr. Benzio, you love this idea of decision-making as superpower. Start us off today.
Yeah. So, whenever Solomon had a wish, could wish for anything, no matter what, he had an incredibly dysfunctional childhood. Dad had 7 wives, 8 wives, had a bunch of stepmothers, brother raped a sister, brother killed a brother. He could have wished for anything he would have wanted. And he wished for wisdom, or as my second grade Sunday school teacher said, godly decision-making skills. And so what we realize is no matter what else he would have wished for, he could have wished for wealth. He could have wished for marriage. He could have wished for health. But if you're a poor decision maker, you would lose it.
And God blessed him for that request, didn't he?
And the very next verse is, and God was pleased and gave him everything else. So God realized it was a wise decision that he wished for wisdom in the process. So in our, in our life, decision-making determines our course of our life. But yet so many people don't really understand how do they make decisions? What goes on in their mind? It's like a black box to them. It's something that's sort of mysterious, overwhelming, complex, that they don't have any access to, that they don't understand. And so what I try to do is, they say great athletes, the game slows down for them, or they're able to see a couple plays ahead. And so many times in our life, we make decisions and 10 minutes later, we're like, oh man, why did I say that? Why did I do that? Oh, that was stupid. I should have never done that. But if we can slow down our mind, if we can understand, well, what are the steps or what are the components? What are the things that are happening in my brain when here's a situation between that time of have a situation to I make a decision, we can understand what's going on there. And that slows down the game for the patient or the person so that they can understand what's going on. And then we can be better stewards of our decision-making process.
So healthy decision-making. Here's a premise, actually things I've actually stated. See if you agree. Healthy decision-making requires a healthy mind.
What are you defining as mind?
So mind is the mental, and computer analogy, the software methodologies and pathways.
An operating system.
The operating system of the not the hardware, not the brain.
Correct.
Okay. But a healthy mind will also require a healthy brain. If you have a dysfunctional brain, then that undermines the operating of the mind. But it's ultimately not the brain that's making decisions. The mind is making decisions. And when the mind makes decisions, the brain reacts to those decisions or responds to those mm-hmm. decisions. For instance, if you make a decision to learn to play the piano and you practice, the brain will make new pathways to help you become proficient over time. The brain is not deciding. The mind is deciding. So decision-making your superpower, I want to put out this premise for our listening audience that if you want to actually have really superpowers in decision-making, you need a healthy mind. And healthy minds are not inherited. They're developed.
Mm-hmm.
Are we on agreement so far?
Well, I think if we look at that computer analogy, there's the hardware of the computer.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
brain.
The keyboard, the monitor, the mouse, the circuit board. That's equivalent to the biochemistry of who we are, our brain and our brain.
And there's certain aspects of inheritance on that. On the hardware piece.
On the hardware piece. But that's the hardware of what we have.
But I'm saying this because I want our audience to understand this, that layers of responsibility.
Let me just go to the analogy first. So then so that's equivalent to our physical sphere. Then we have the operating system, which determines how we take in information, process it, and spit it out. That's equivalent to that psychological or the mind sphere of that, spirit, mind, body. Then we have the spiritual sphere. So the spiritual sphere I divide up into two elements, the external spiritual sphere, which is God, Satan, angels, heaven, hell, and the internal spiritual sphere, which is my individual spirit that makes me unique, separates me, makes me different than animals or than a clone of me, allows me to connect to God in ways that I couldn't without a spirit, gives me an awareness of myself bigger than I would if I didn't have a spirit. And so in that computer analogy, the internal spiritual sphere is equivalent to the owner of the computer, and the external spiritual sphere is God or the designer of the computer. So in order for the computer to work well, we need good hardware, that brain chemistry. We need a good mind, good operating system. We don't want like a three-year-old or an immature, a Windows 95 operating system. We want as a mature mind and operating system as possible. But the owner of the computer has to be on the same page or using the instruction manual of the designer. So that's where that belief system or that spiritual element informs the mind so that we can have a healthy mind, which then informs the brain or ripples into, through neuroplasticity, that brain chemistry, those brain circuits. So that's sort of, in my mind, sort of a simple way to, you know, bring all three of those spheres in a way that is a little bit more practical for patients or people to understand how these three very interesting design that God has for us of these three spheres actually come together and impact and play off each other.
Danielle, do you have anything you want to add to that?
I love that analogy. I think I'm just processing what you said and piecing it together in my own understanding. I'm also connecting it to what you were saying about Solomon and his really difficult childhood experiences and how that probably, or we know that that would lead to some level of unhealth, but he had a relationship with God that sounds like it was healthy.
So for me, again, healthy mind is not inherited.
Right.
That's developed through life experiences. Mm-hmm. And the healthy mind is a mind that develops the faculties that God has given us along those principles of God's kingdom, which he has built into reality and described in his word, such as Isaiah 1:18, come let us reason together, though your sins are like scarlet, they'll be white like snow. God connects reasoning with him and cleansing from sin. A lot of people never realize that. Reasoning is connected with cleansing because you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. And you actually can't know the truth if you don't comprehend or think through the truth. Every person must be fully persuaded in their own mind. And so these are principles. We have an ability to reason and think. This sets us apart from the animals. That ability can be developed or atrophied.
Correct.
And if you don't develop reasoning abilities, I'll see if you agree. And if you disagree, help me understand why. But if you don't develop reasoning abilities, you can't have a healthy mind.
I think it's that using that in that designer's instruction manual.
Whether you're using it or not, don't develop those abilities, if you don't have no ability to reason, you can't have a healthy mind.
Well, using some of those instructions allows us the ability to reason.
Yeah, but that is not the question on the table. The question on the table is if people don't use that or don't use any reason, don't develop their reasoning skills, they let them atrophy, can they have a healthy mind without it?
Really hard. Almost impossible.
You can't because the way God designed us, he designed us in his image. And he is a reasonable being and he's an intelligent being and he wants us to develop those abilities. And in the law of exertion, if you exercise those abilities, neurobiologically they change. You practice your instrument, neural networks improve. You work a lot of math problems, neural networks improve. They scanned taxi drivers in London, their brain, and the part of the brain that corresponds with know where you are in three-dimensional space around you is markedly hypertrophied with lots of connections compared to the average person because of all the streets they've learned geographically. Mm-hmm. Our brains change. If we don't use reasoning ability, then we don't develop those skills. Mm-hmm. And brain doesn't develop that way. Mm-hmm. And that undermines our ability to have a healthy mind. Yeah, the decision-making powers. I mean, if somebody, and there are people who have destroyed their capacity for reason. Now, I'm not talking insanity. I'm not talking insanity.
So when you say they can either develop healthy or they can atrophy,
yeah.
To me, there's a third option. It could be corrupted or sabotaged.
Okay. So describe what that looks like.
So that's where, you know, to me, atrophy is sort of neutral but not working well, whereas sabotage is it's actually working against what the goals are.
So
So to me, an atrophied mind might be somebody who has intellectual disability and maybe mental retardation, or just has a limited IQ ability, like a Down syndrome.
And we wouldn't say that's a healthy mind.
We wouldn't say it's a healthy mind, but it's more of an atrophied mind. It's not necessarily an evil mind.
I didn't say evil, or
a corrupted mind.
Okay.
So a corrupted mind is sort of allowing Satan's lie. So in that computer analogy, there's computer viruses that are coming in that are trying to sabotage the operating system or the healthy functioning of a mind, right? And sort of leading it astray. So it's using reasoning abilities, but it's corrupting the reasoning because they're using illogical data to come to conclusions that are antithetical to the health design laws.
So I've only identified one faculty, the faculty of reason. And I'm just pointing out, if that faculty is dysfunctional, we're not going to have a healthy mind. Mm-hmm. But you're pointing out there are other elements. It's not reason. Reason alone is not sufficient to have a healthy mind. For instance, I think Satan can reason, plot, strategize, plan, organize.
Very good.
Okay? But he doesn't have a healthy mind. Because there's another faculty that God has given us that, as I understand, works together with our reason. That's our conscience.
Mm-hmm.
Our conscience. Now maybe, and I'm going to suggest, if you have a unhealthy or seared, even destroyed, can people destroy their conscience?
Yeah.
And if you do that, Satan, I would suggest this is his problem. Not that he's not intellectual, but he has a destroyed conscience. He can still reason, but his conclusions in God's kingdom become unreasonable.
Correct.
Even though he can still reason because he has a destroyed conscience.
So that's a sabotage or corrupted
mind. Yes, that's the corrupted mind. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the ability, so the mental retarded person would have atrophied or non-developed ability to reason. So they're very naive. They can make lots of decisions you might consider foolish or harmful without evil intent. Okay. Mm-hmm. They couldn't discern right from wrong necessarily. Okay, but
they're mainly mimicking
exactly.
What has been modeled for them,
right,
and sort of copying that, as opposed to a reasoning person isn't copying.
But the sociopath, they can be highly intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
They can think cause from effect. They can understand problems. They can, but they have no conscience.
And they can plot out any steps ahead.
Such that the reasoning abilities are corrupted with evil intents and evil motives. And so that's where the conscience piece comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes then, the conscience piece connects to what you said earlier, our spirit. The conscience is the part of our being that is sensitive to the movements of the Holy Spirit and gives us that spiritual drive to love, to forgive, to be Christ-like. That is not natural to the fear-ridden, selfish heart.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, service, you know, all those kind of things.
Sure. So healthy decision-making.
Against the sin nature.
So healthy decision-making requires a healthy mind, and my view of that is a healthy mind starts with a healthy reason and healthy conscience.
Mm-hmm. And I would agree with that.
Yeah. And if we have those, then the healthy mind functions in a certain way. And the function is, and this is where now the decision-making includes, see if this is what you mean by it. Decision-making is not conclusion-making. You can come to a smoker can come to a conclusion that smoking is bad.
Mm-hmm.
They have reasoned it out, and their conscience may even convict them to quit. And they tell their kids never start, it's a horrible habit. They've concluded it's wrong, but they haven't decided to put the cigarettes down. So decision making is more than conclusion making.
Yeah, so it might be a conclusion they make consciously, but unconsciously, there's other competing conclusions that they're also drawing from it. So that it might be a competing conclusion is that I'm really stressed and a cigarette de-stresses me. So I've come to the conclusion that it's harmful to my lungs, but I'll deal with that 20 years from now. Right now, I'm really stressed and the only thing that relaxes me is a cigarette.
But see that what you just described, is a lie operating instead of the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in their unconscious space, we have a lot of illogical information that's mm-hmm. stored there that plays out and influences the conclusions that we draw and the decisions that we make.
So for a healthy mind, we're talking about decision making. Let's use that example as an analogy. Somebody has awareness of something like smoking that's not good, but they're not deciding to put it down. Perhaps they have, and I've had some patients actually say it consciously, it helps me relax. Mm-hmm. I would call that a rationalization. But that's where they are. How would you guide them through if they wanted to really say, I want my mind to be healthy. I want to actually use my superpower of decision making to make healthy decisions. Where do they go? What do they look for in that dynamic when they know that it's healthy to quit, but they have some idea that it's competing and or feeling that's competing?
Mm-hmm.
How do you help them navigate to get to the point they can make that healthy decision?
So as I look at decisions, I look at there's six components of every decision we make. There's a stimulus or situation that stimulates our decision-making process.
So in the smoker, what's the stimulus?
It could be...
He's already smoking, not starting. He's already
yeah,
smoking.
Yeah, so it could be that there was a... somebody at work said something that was antagonistic to him.
So I think the stimulus for the smoker is he's addicted and it's a habit.
But there's a specific decision he's going to make right now to smoke.
It's just not out of habit. So there's not like you make a decision to drink water. You make a decision to eat food when you get hungry. He gets an internal signal. I'm a nicotine craving.
He's going to go on break from his job. And there was some stress.
So you're saying if he doesn't have that stress, he won't smoke.
Maybe not.
So he'll quit if he doesn't have stress.
Well,
I'm challenging that. I think he's addicted. I think he's going to keep smoking whether he has stress at work or not.
Well, he has a situation.
Okay.
He's going out on break. He feels stressed. He has an option. Do I smoke or not smoke? He always has that option. Do I smoke or not smoke? So he has a perception of his situation that,
Let me reframe this so I can be on board with you. The reframe is he's wanting to quit, but he's having interference with it, and this is the stress.
Whether he wants to quit or not, here's a situation. It stands alone. There's influencers that comes in.
I'm just not buying your story. If he's addicted to tobacco and he doesn't want to quit, it doesn't matter whether he has stress. When he goes on break, he's going to smoke. He just got the announcement he got a raise. He's going to go on break and smoke.
Well, when he goes on break, he's going to want to smoke.
Right. I mean,
but
he's going to want to smoke.
I think that's different than when he goes on break, he's going to smoke.
Yeah, so he has a situation. I'm going on break.
Okay.
He has a perception of, whatever that looks like. Here's my past. Here's what my, automated process is. Every time I've gone on break in the past, I smoke.
I
had stress I have something I want to celebrate.
Yeah, okay.
And so in his unconscious space, he's sorting through data of, what do I do on this break? I'm a smoker. I like to smoke. Boy, I like the taste of smoke.
Okay.
It's relaxing to me. It takes an edge off. It reduces stress. He's sorting through all kind of data. He has options. One option is I don't smoke. One option is I do smoke. One option is, I only smoke half a cigarette. One option is that, I don't have any cigarettes, so I ask Danielle for a cigarette. So he has a bunch of options, and then he's going to pull the trigger on an option. Right.
Yeah.
And so all this background information of, I've smoked for the last 20 years and I don't know anything else. I don't know how to quit. Maybe I want to quit. Maybe my wife is sick of this. I'm trying to hide it. So I need a lifesaver afterwards. So then he pulls the trigger on the decision to smoke, and he smokes. Then he has a summary thought. Is that working for me? And so the addict always has that summary thought of, that decreased my stress, that allowed me an escape. It was a distraction from the workplace situation. They might have a little bit of guilt. Oh man, I screwed up. I smoked again. But there's competing stuff that's going on inside that's saying, that was disconcerting for me, and alienating to me in some way. But the benefits I got from it outweighed this. Now, are they looking long term cost and benefit ratio, or just most people are me. Now-centered, within the next 15 seconds, sort of our microwave society element of it. So those are the six elements in the decision. Those are the cascade that we go through each time. We have opportunities to intervene in those. Usually the emotion and the perception are the two main ones, but because our mind, the good news is God gave us a powerful mind. The bad news is God gave us a powerful mind. So our mind works so quickly, and what we're trying to do is, how do we slow down that process? So especially for an addict, instead of this just automatic process happening, there is stuff going on inside. It's all unconscious for that person that's sort of
never really
compulsive behavior. So we're trying to bring that to consciousness to show him, hey, you do have opportunities to intervene in this situation. It does take effort. It does take energy. It does take strategy, and try to help them understand that what you're doing is more harmful to you than the pain it would take to restrain or restrict from having that.
I've actually never met an addict, not never one, and I've treated I don't know how many over the years, that believed their addiction was healthy for them. Never met one.
Mm-hmm.
I had never met an addict that thought their life was better because of the addiction, that was helpful to them, that it wasn't harmful to them. So I never met an addict that needed more cognitive information and facts about the harm of their addiction. That was never the issue. Let's give them some more data. Let's give them more facts. I've never met an addict who uses because they believe that it's beneficial. They're all under some sense of conviction and wrong, not just from criminal wrong from society, but the impact it's having on their life if they're an actual addict.
That's their intellectual creed.
Yeah.
Deep inside, their sort of real creed is something different. So they believe that there's something, you know, in the stages of addiction, there's, you know, experimental use, social use, circumstantial use. And that's the dangerous stage, circumstantial use. Because when there's that circumstantial use, then a person believes that, wow, this is beneficial for me in this circumstance.
I disagree. I don't think they believe that. I think they feel that. I think they have a affective connection to their addiction that comforts them and makes them feel better. And they feel comforted and they feel relief and they have a positive affective valence. To think of it, they get what I call the warm fuzzy, that'd be nice. That would. And that feeling then makes them feel helped emotionally, but they never think factually that it's beneficial for them. I think it's an emotion.
I think consciously, but unconsciously, I think they do. There's some reward for engaging that behavior.
Yeah,
some of it's an emotional reward, but I think there's some of it thinking that their life is enhanced or this particular issue is temporarily fixed for me to go. So as an alcoholic, as a recovering alcoholic, that was my part of my process.
So
it's having that unconscious information.
Did you not have a place where when you would think of alcohol, you would get what I call the warm fuzzy? Oh, that'd be nice. It was a positive emotional experience.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was just it just.
So did you ever have this experience?
Issues that I had.
Let me contrast. If I were to offer you right now a warm bowl of dog droppings with a spoon, would you, and it got close to you, would you get an emotional reaction?
Yeah.
And it would be disgust, revulsion.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you ever have that reaction when you thought of alcohol? Revulsion and disgust.
At times, not very often.
Mm-hmm. And the times that would cause that were the times that you would drink the most? In other words, when you're feeling disgust, were you going out and drinking or were you avoiding it?
A little bit of both.
Yeah, because in my experience, people don't drink or use their substances if they actually have revulsion to it. People don't take into things they're revolted from, unless they are masochistic and they're wanting to punish themselves, which is a different form or problem than most addictions. Most addictions are not used by the person in real time because they want to punish themselves. They're used because they want to relieve something and they want to get the warm fuzzy.
Yeah, I think it's more of a competing elements. So there might be something that, I'm repulsed by the need to drink or the urge to drink, but I'm more repulsed by this other rejection that I'm feeling by this other person. So because this one outweighs this one, I want to avoid this one as much as possible. And alcohol allows me to avoid this. So I'm going to use alcohol, even though I'm not thrilled and I know it's problematic for me and I'm somewhat repulsed by it. This one is even more repulsing.
Yep.
This one is
so,
more threatening
so back
to my identity,
it's
my emotions,
my emotional decision. They're not doing it rationally. They're doing it because they will feel better or feel less distressed with the alcohol than the other thing.
And it's not happening consciously.
Yeah.
It's happening in my unconscious space.
That's what I'm saying. That's the emotional decision. Yeah. So, okay. So healthy decision-making requires a healthy reason, healthy conscience, and some healthy capacity to manage emotions.
Very much so. So that's that third component. So there's stimulus perception. How are we seeing that situation? What is the reasoning? What is the truth? Are we having clear lenses, godly lenses, healthy lenses to see it? Are we having these lenses that have, you know, are we taking every thought captive
so
the obedience of Christ? And then we have the emotions or that third step. So then how do we manage those emotions so those emotions are a good warning system, but not our decision-making system?
So I'm outlining different faculties, the ability to reason,
mm-hmm.
a conscience, emotions, these are different mental faculties. Mm. And then the critical one, where it all hinges, everything falls on this, is what I call the will, which is only the chooser, the part of your brain when you go, I choose to do this. I choose to do that. The part that makes the choice, which is what I call the will. It's not willpower. It's just the choice. And that part that chooses might be governed by emotions or in spite of emotions. Example, Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane had powerful emotions that were stronger than I think any other, but he still made the choice based on truth and conscience, reason and conscience, truth. And so we don't have to let our power of choice, the decision, be made by emotion.
Correct. We don't want it to be made by emotion.
Right. And this, and to the degree that it is, it's often results in harm. Because that seems to be the tension. Healthy minds are not cyborgs. Healthy minds are not emotionless minds. But healthy minds are able to make choices that their reason conscience would validate in spite of uncomfortable feelings. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, our emotions are a very important facet of who we are. God's an emotional being.
Yeah.
We're made in his likeness, so we have all kinds of emotions too. As guys, you know, growing up in the 60s, 70s, we were taught to stuff all your uncomfortable or negative emotions. Well, you read in the Bible, God has a lot of uncomfortable negative emotions. As you just said, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus had some very uncomfortable emotions. So those emotions serve a purpose. They're our warning system. They let us know when something's not going right, there's potential danger, or we're not seeing things clearly. So we need to have those initial emotions.
And motivators.
Just like whenever somebody gets raped or murdered, we need to have emotions of fear, anger, frustration, anxiety. I don't want my wife to be, you know, endangered by somebody, perpetrator out there. So we have these emotions that motivate us, that energize us, that let us know that something's not going right here. But in the past, we had that lynch mob mentality where we let our emotions become our decision makers and we hung the wrong person. So what we realize is, well, emotions aren't good decision makers. We need to have court. And so in court, we want to figure out what happened, what's the stimulus, how to process the data, the information, how to reason through it to then spit out a decision that's correct for that scenario. So what do we do with emotions in court? We remove them, right? We want the initial emotion that motivates us and energizes us into a court process, but then we remove them by picking a judge and a jury that's not related to the defendant or victim so they can process the information clearly and accurately to then render a good, healthy decision. So purging our emotions isn't a healthy thing. God doesn't want us to purge our emotions. He wants us to be emotional beings, but he doesn't want us to be emotional decision makers either. And that's sort of where, you know, we sort of go on one extreme or the other, we end up stuffing our emotions, trying to ignore them, but then we're not getting warned. Just like if we break the smoke detector, well, we're not getting warned when there's a fire, or we let the pressure build, but can't keep it in. And then all of a sudden we blow, we make an emotional decision. That gets us in trouble. We're like, boy, you know, I can't stuff them, but I can't let them make decisions. And we're sort of stuck between these two extremes as opposed to, well, no, there's a gray area where they can be our warning system. And then we exert that reasoning ability to then let it, you know, think both from our unconscious space and our conscious space to render a decision.
The Bible tells us in James 1 that our feelings lead us into temptation. So we have to be careful if we just let them run wild. And either one of you, any suggestions, thoughts to our audience, if they, because I suspect there's a lot of people that struggle with very powerful emotions. What are some tools people can use when emotions seem overwhelming, other than trying to medicate them, self-medicate with substances, which is often, we have patients that they're just using it to try to calm down. They're not trying to be bad people. They're just feeling overwhelmed with emotions. Mm-hmm. What tools can people use to process the emotion in a healthy way to strengthen their decision-making superpower?
Yeah, well, I think both of you are saying some really valuable things. A lot of things that actually I haven't really heard before. And so I'm going to be thinking about this later. But something I'm not really hearing is talking about what needs are being met. And I think that a lot of the time without realizing it, and this is connected to kind of the unconscious things that you were talking about, is there's needs that we have that are not being met in healthy ways elsewhere in our life. And by needs, I'm talking about like connection, nurturance, calm, these different things that God created us for. And if we're not going to God for wholeness, nurturance, these different things, if we're not taking care of our body, we're not doing different things that lead us to health, then there are needs that are being unmet. And then we end up making a decision out of wanting that need to be met that doesn't actually meet it in the long term, but feels like it meets it in the temporary. So I've had a lot of people that I've worked with who, once they realize, they what the core need is that they were trying to meet with their behavior, they can then learn, how do I meet this need in other ways so that I don't have this big empty spot that I'm trying to, you know, make sudden decisions to fill without really thinking through it clearly.
So this is so well said. I'm going to flip this right back to you after I kind of frame what you said. The need mm-hmm. unmet would naturally and in a healthy way generate intense emotions, mm-hmm. just like if you have a wound and you feel pain, the pain is a natural response to bring your attention to it, to address the wound and heal it.
That's the warning sign.
The warning sign.
Right.
So it's the intense emotions are to draw the attention. There's something, you know, I'm starving, I'm dying of thirst, whatever.
Yes.
To get the actual true need resolved.
Yes.
But unhealthiness would be substituting anything other than what the actual need is.
Yes.
And that then does not resolve the pain, may inflame it even.
Yes.
And then we get in cycles of dysfunction. So you actually, whether you realize it or not, cited a couple of things that people were not doing or not getting. Cite directly the places people can go to meet some of these needs and the things you might recommend to your patients as the true source of a need. And spell that out for our audience so they can see that.
Yeah, so one thing that I see a lot is the need for emotional intimacy and connection, like healthy, deep connection with community. And people can meet that in maybe when they have maybe a lack of identity or sense of self, they aren't really fully able to connect with other people the way that we were designed to. And so maybe they turn to unhealthy relationships that are really quick. So maybe there's a term trauma dumping where people just immediately say everything and try to seek this very quick emotional intimacy that's not genuine. And what that leads is to some chaotic, tumultuous relationships. But what's healthy is learning, developing a sense of self, learning how to, over time, begin to trust somebody, build a relationship with them, get to know them, and forming and finding a community of people that want to know you, want to support you. And that can help meet some of these needs of connection and belonging.
I agree with everything you just described. I'm just wondering if somebody's listening said, yeah, yes, I want connection. Where's the resource?
Mm-hmm.
Where do I go? I mean, you mentioned in your initial statement, they're not getting something from God.
Mm-hmm.
Is God a resource they can go to?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. I mean,
yes.
And how does that work? What is it that they can and even are supposed to get from God?
Mm-hmm.
That would, you know, be
love, intimacy, connection.
Okay.
Knowing,
so
sense of being known and loved.
Yes. And so we talked in another show about attachment versus bonding.
Yes.
My view of attachment is attachments are dependent. Like a fetus is attached to the mother via an umbilical cord. A young child is attached to the parents being all the dependency needs they have of a child to be parented and cared for and nurtured and so forth. But attachments are eventually to be severed, just like the umbilical cord, so that a healthy self can then have bonding, which is non-dependent. It's a loving, giving bond of affection and commitment, whether it's friendship or otherwise. But with one exception, I think we can have attachment to God. And that's the only place. So that attachment from parents is to be transferred to a relationship with God. And what I was hearing you say is that some people don't make that transfer, and therefore either they have a need for love, nurturance, presence, whatever, that they're not deriving from God. It will leave them empty, leave them void, lack of purpose, lack of wholeness, and they will try to fill it in relationships, and then get these codependency relationships as they're trying to draw internal wholeness from other people.
Yes.
And so have I heard you correctly what you were trying to describe?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I want to connect this back to what you were saying in the beginning with Solomon and his choice to ask God for wisdom. He had a close enough relationship with God for God to ask him what he wanted.
Yeah. And I think that was an attachment or a dependent relationship. He's dependent on God.
Yeah.
And because it was healthy and they could have that conversation, and then the wisdom was poured in like the umbilical cord. It wasn't something that Solomon could have gone out and pulled off the trees himself and gotten. It was poured into him from the, you know, source of all wisdom. Mm-hmm. And so that was a very healthy attachment and relationship.
And I don't think we see God as that sort of psychological provider of these kind of assets or resources that we that
should.
We
should we?
What's that?
Should we see him though?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. So he's the provider, and if we don't look to him, we know Satan is very good at presenting reasonable facsimiles or imposters that promise to offer those things that we're looking for of self identity, ability, specialness, attention. Love, unconditional love, safety, consistency, meaning, to me, they spell out sarcasm, those elements. So, we're always looking for sarcasm. We need God to provide those for us. And then God will provide other venues here on our sort of biophysical plane here to be able to access those things from him. But Satan is going to give us a bunch of imposters that promise those things. And that's where we keep on chasing because we have these needs. We want to fulfill these needs. And we're always looking, but sometimes we don't think of God as sort of being that psychological, or since he's not there sitting on the table or somebody I can just call on the cell phone real quick to meet those needs, or something I can pick up at the store, that Satan provides these very tangible, physical things for us to access. And we're sort of lazy psychologically and lazy spiritually, so we go for the quick fixes.
Yeah. But do you, what you're just saying about God the source, Solomon, what about, do you see that described by Jesus with the woman at the well, when he talks about the water of life that wells up inside her and flows out to many?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Unpack that for us. This water of life, I think it's describing like love and so forth, but flowing out to many. So, healthy minds, are they only people who reason and plan for self, or you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah. So, most of the things that God creates, just like our circulatory system is circular, so it's a big process. We're not the end point of it. Whether it's forgiveness, we receive it and we send it out. Whether it's love, we receive it, we send it out. Money, we receive it and we send it out.
And the more you receive,
the more you get,
or the more you give, the more you receive.
Yeah. And so whenever we become the stopper of that, well, that blocks up the whole system and the system stagnates, it gets putrid. And instead of a wellspring that's life-giving, it ends up being a toxic, wellspring of life that flows out of our heart or doesn't flow because we're blocking it. Yeah. So that ability to be to be light and to be salt in this world comes from our ability to access this, unlimited, infinite resource of God, but then not to hoard it. But, if we really love God, then we, I love my wife. I don't really like flowers, but as I learn more about my wife and learn to love her more, I start to love the things that she loves because I love her. And so if we really love God, we start to, as we spend time with him, we start to love the things that he loves. Well, he loves people. So he doesn't just love me, but he loves, all the other people. Well, if I just hoard stuff and not share it, well, am I really loving God and loving the least of these or the other people that he's put in my life to love or to share with or to serve in various kind of ways, as opposed to, well, no, it's just coming to me and I'm just going to hoard it.
So we're talking about healthy mind. I'm trying to recap in sum. Healthy mind, healthy reason, healthy conscience, healthy management of emotions, healthy, and then we choose reasonably, but we also have deep, abiding, healthy sense of self, which is not just those faculties, healthy sense of self built upon a trust relationship with our Creator, who, where our identity is found, receiving from him the love that we cannot create by willpower. Mm. We can't create that by will. We receive it. But then a healthy mind chooses to share that love in various domains. Somebody might share that love through art. Is that not right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Somebody might share that through caregiving or lecturing or doing a podcast. I mean, this is all.
I thought you were going to say pickleball.
Possible. Your pickleball ministry right there. Okay. But there's truth in that. Uh-huh. Okay. There's not just one way to share love.
Exactly.
Okay. And it is a way of living for the benefit of others.
And that's why your care team at church needs to be a bunch of different people, because we're all different body parts with different skills, different abilities, different backstories, different issues, alcohol, sexual abuse, depression, anxiety, abortion. God wants to use those because you're going to be uniquely able to care for or understand or empathize or connect to somebody who's also struggling with something like that. Not everybody has lived a life like Carl and going to exactly and connect with me. I have a different personality. I'm not going to connect with her. But Martine, my wife, has a different personality. There's people that she's able to connect with and care for that I'm not able to, and there's people that I can.
Absolutely.
She's not. That's why we need this community, and the more connection and the more community, the more we're able to care for each other, and the whole body is healthy, not just, okay, I got two organs that are healthy,
yeah,
and the rest of it isn't.
So healthy mind. I want to kind of sum up and close out this section with I think the big principles. When we have reason, conscience, manage our emotions, decision-making, connection with God, the three big principles that we practice, and the devil will try to trick us, are the love we talked about, altruism, other-centeredness, but the love, Bible tells us, rejoices with the truth in 1 Corinthians 13, rejoices with truth. So we actually cannot, there is emotional love, compassion, empathy. There's functional love, doing what actually is good for people. Mm-hmm. That may not feel good, but it's actually really good in harmony with the kingdom of God and his principles.
And it's really the loving thing to do.
Yes, the loving thing to do, even if it doesn't necessarily feel love. Mm-hmm. And a healthy mind will move in that direction. But the applying the principles of truth and governance of self in their relationship with people for the benefit of people. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And then the other big one is under the umbrella of freedom. Mm. Under the umbrella of freedom, because you can't actually advance God's cause using Satan's methods.
Mm-hmm.
And God leaves us free. Love only grows in freedom.
Free will.
And we saw during a crisis worldwide that wonderful goal, let's save lives. What was applied in many places in which liberties of people were restricted. Civil liberties, religious liberties, and consciences were coerced. Do this or else. Mm-hmm. You will lose your job. You will lose your funding. You will lose your platform. You will lose your scholarship. You will not be able to attend classes. You will, et cetera. The consciences were coerced for a good goal. We want to save lives.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the devil tricks. In some places in the Dark Ages, some people were burning people at the stake to save souls.
Mm-hmm.
Eternal souls. We're not going to just save a temporal life for 70 years. No, this is eternity. I mean, it's a big deal. We love people. Let's burn them so we can save their soul. I mean, good goal. Terrible method. Mm-hmm. And so healthy minds not only use reason and have clear conscience and process their emotions, and when they make decisions, they make them in harmony with the big principles of God,
mm-hmm.
truth, love, and freedom. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that self-awareness is so important to be able to understand, what am I thinking? How am I reasoning? How am I managing my feelings? But really, for my life and the people I work with, it's really being able to understand what's going on in that unconscious space. And are we really abiding by those principles that you laid out? Or we think we are, but in actuality, we're really abiding by something different. And to me, the beauty of decision-making and the superpower in it is that if we're making a wrong decision, we can use that decision by unpacking it, sort of doing
looking at the outcome consequence,
doing an autopsy of it to sort of see, well, why did I make that decision? It's not a healthy decision. What was going on inside me? Was I being an emotional decision maker? Were there needs I was trying to get them met in an unhealthy way? Was I not using reason? Was I using my reason, or was I using God's biblical reason? Whenever you make a wrong decision, yeah, you want to repent, but don't just throw it away. Examine it and figure out, well, why did it? Because there's great information residing in that if we unpack it and ask God's guidance as we're unpacking the show, to reveal to me what's going on in my heart that made the illogical option look logical and the logical option look illogical in that millisecond.
What are your thoughts or the primary reason people resist doing the autopsy of their decisions? They don't want to look.
they're afraid of what they're going to find.
Fear, which can result in shame and guilt.
Mm-hmm.
Shame and guilt. Mm-hmm. And the shame and guilt flames up the fear of what other people think about me, rejection. And so there's a form of denial going on in avoiding the look.
And I think there's a sense of impotence that I'm not going to be able to change it anyways, or I don't have much power. I don't have much, but I've tried to change. I've tried to stop smoking for 20 years now, and I just haven't. And so I think there's that impotence, and it's going to reveal the impotence. And that's why we need that connection with God to provide us that power to be able to see and then to move in a way of doing something different instead of just doing the same old, same old.
So let's close. I'm going to close out with this. Healthy minds have a healthy connection with God. And I want our audience to understand where the power comes from and how the Holy Spirit works with their mind. This is my understanding. Holy Spirit is the Spirit of truth, which will bring truth to our minds if we're asking and seeking in ways that we are personally able to comprehend in our journey what the next truth in our life the Holy Spirit wants us to apply. And we'll come to a point that we understand, this is for me, this is where I'm at in my journey. And then we're left completely free to say yes and apply the truth, or delay, avoid, not apply it. It's
or bastardize it. We usually take snippets of it that fit our need in that moment, and then we'll...
It is only when we choose the truth that the Holy Spirit's brought to us that we actually receive the divine power to succeed. We don't get the power of God to succeed until we make the choice. And many people wait or beg for the power when they actually still haven't decided whether they want to do it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's a trap. Mm-hmm. And the reason for this is the only way God can heal hearts and minds and retain the individuality of the person completely is by leaving them free to choose each step. If he uses power to push them that they haven't chosen for, then he's actually rewriting their individuality and slowly erasing them. And he won't do that. He loves every person and wants to retain every individual person and their individuality. And that's why he leads us with truth, leaves us free. And then as soon as we choose it, we're not left free on our own to do it in our own strength. We receive anything he calls us to do. He always provides the resources and ability to do. But we have to choose it.
I think in Jesus' healing prescription in Matthew 13, verse 15, he says that they would see with their eyes, see the situation, see themselves, see God, hear with their ears, hear God's answer, the truth, the reasoning that's biblical, understand in their heart with that, I want to change, but they're not acting on it. He doesn't just say understand. He says, and turn, meaning I'm willing to make
choose,
a decision.
And choose.
I'm willing to make a choice,
yeah.
And put that, trust that enough that I'm willing to put it into action in the form of a decision, then that healing happens.
There it is.
So that's where you're.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Thank you. I hadn't connected those two. Well, thank you for joining us today. Hope this program on decision-making was helpful to you. If you have questions, send those in to designformore.net, designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.